Okay, after having this easy discussion about risk adjustment, we now go to contract boundaries, and I give the floor to Roberta.
Thank you, Martin. So agenda paper 3 addresses a number of questions that we have received on contract boundary. The paper includes two main topics. Firstly, the possible limitation to an entity's practical ability to reprice contracts. And secondly, how IFRS 17 creates options to add coverage. So to optimize the discussion, I would propose to discuss the two topics separately. So I will firstly introduce the first topic in the paper, which is topic A. The submissions ask what constraints or limitations, other than those arising from the terms of an insurance contract, would be relevant in assessing the practical ability of an entity to reassess the risks of the particular policyholder or of the portfolio of insurance contracts that contain the contract, and set a price or level of benefits that fully reflects those risks. The analysis in the paper notes that a constraint that equally applies to new contracts and to existing contracts would not limit an entity's practical ability to reprice existing contracts to reflect their reassessed risk. When determining whether it has the practical ability to set a price at a future date that fully reflects the reassessed risk of a contract or portfolio, an entity shall consider contractual, legal, and regulatory restrictions, and shall ignore restrictions that have no commercial substance. IFRS 17 does not limit the pricing constraints to contractual, legal, and regulatory constraints. So market competitiveness and commercial considerations are factors that an entity typically consider when pricing new contracts and when repricing existing contracts. And finally, a constraint that limits an entity's practical ability to price or reprice contracts differs from choices that an entity makes, i.e. pricing decisions, which may not limit the entity's practical ability to reprice existing contracts. So we would like to get your views on the accounting analysis set out in the paper for this first topic.
JP?
Yes, thanks, Maureen. The first issue about, you know, whether the commercial constraints like market competitiveness is relevant in assessing the contract boundary. QA regards it's not relevant. QB thinks it's relevant, right? So I have the same view with the step, which is constraints like market competitiveness is not relevant to the contract boundary assessment as long as they equally apply to new and existing policyholders. But from a practical perspective or auditor's perspective, I think it would be really challenging to estimate, to judge how commercial constraints affect new and existing contracts equally. So the commercial constraints may or may not apply equally to new and existing contracts, right? So if consideration to don't apply equally to new and existing contracts, the boundary is likely to prolong to the end, right? So personally, I like this kind of conclusion because I believe the boundary for life insurance product with the long-term nature, you know, should prolong to the end to reflect its economic reality. That's my view.
Okay. Thanks. Daechong?
Well, it's one of the big 2 points here. Point one is regarding this topic A. I see the analysis in the paper. It's very clear. And the conclusion reasonable, although in a number of markets, some regulatory constraint exist, and we do need to assess those in more detail. You know, overall, I'm fine with that. Yeah. Secondly, I want to make a point as to paragraph 14 of the paper. I recall that's during the last TRG meeting, there were more than just one view or one observation. Yeah. The observation noted here, it's a paragraph 34 B is a natural extension of paragraph 34 A. That wasn't uniform across all the members. Yeah. They have different observation make in that you know, you can have situation whereby the entity may not have practical ability to assess risk at the individual policyholder level, but because of the law of large number, can access a risk at the group of contract level. And when you look at a group of contract, the risk profile will differ. You know, lapse risk and other risks will come into the picture. So I just want to make that point.
So everybody agrees to the analysis in the paper? As I said, it's easy. Let's go to the next.
Okay. So let's move to the second topic in the paper, topic B. The submissions ask how to determine the contract boundary of insurance contracts that include an option to add insurance coverage at a future date. For those contracts, the entity is obligated to provide additional coverage if the policyholder exercises the option. And it is assumed that the entity has no right to compel the policyholder to pay premiums. This assumption is not clearly specified in the paper, but I think that might be useful to clarify this. The submissions distinguish between terms that are guaranteed by the entity. This means that the entity sets the premium for the additional coverage at inception and cannot reprice the premiums for the additional coverage to reflect the reassessed risk of the policyholder or of the portfolio that contains the contract. And the terms that are not guaranteed by the entity, this means that the entity sets the premiums for the additional coverage only when the policyholder exercises the option. The analysis in the paper notes that an option to add insurance coverage is a feature of the insurance contract. Unless the entity considers that such an option is a separate contract, the option is an insurance component that is not measured separately from the remainder of the insurance contract. For an option with terms that are guaranteed by the entity, the cash flows arising from the option are within the boundary of the contract because the entity cannot reprice the contract in its entirety to reflect the reassessed risk when it has guaranteed the price for one of the risks included in the contract. And for an option with terms that are not guaranteed by the entity, the cash flows arising from the option may be either within or outside the contract boundary. This would depend on whether the entity has the practical ability to set a price for the contract in its entirety, including the option, in a manner that fully reflects the reassessed risk at the same time as the option is exercised. So also for this topic, we would like to get your views on the accounting analysis that is set out in the paper.
Leslie.
Thank you. I agree with everything except for paragraph 42, which that the cash flows will be within the contract boundary for an option to add coverage where the terms of the coverage are equivalent to a new contract. I believe that such cash flows should be outside the contract boundary in my read of the standards. A few places on paragraph 34, I think cash flows are within the boundary of an insurance contract if they arise from substantive rights and obligations that exist during the reporting period. I don't believe that the substantive right and obligation exists if the insurer has the right to set the terms equivalent to a new contract at the time. I think that's also consistent with the spirit of B24, which says because the entity remains free to price the annuity on a basis that reflects the risk that will be transferred at that time, the cash flows that would occur on the exercise of the option fall outside the boundary of the contract. I also believe it's consistent with the previous board discussions, in particular in March 2011, which is the last time the contract boundary was addressed. It talked about voluntary contributions being added to a contract and says if the policyholder decides to make an it differentiates between whether the terms for the voluntary contributions are equivalent to new or not. If they're not equivalent to new, it's within the contract boundary. But if the policyholder decides to make an additional payment on the same terms as new policyholders, the cash flows are outside the boundary of the contract. So everything I've seen in the past suggests that if we have the right to set terms anew, if something would be added at new terms, that that would be outside the contract boundary. We would not consider those cash flows in the current measurement. I think to support the consequence of allowing such cash flows in the current measurement are in some cases difficult to absorb. For example, if we do have those options, we would be making assumptions not only about what policyholders will do, but about what the future management will require, how they will set the price, the profit margin they will require. So this becomes very speculative. It's very difficult to estimate reliably, and you end up inflating your current CSM for those future CSMs, for those future optional additions. A second consequence, which has been very difficult, especially in Canadian contract, relates to reinsurance contracts. It has the consequential implication that all future cessions in a reinsurance treaty open to new business must be included in the measurement of the insurance contract, and not just. We talked about the 90 days worth. If agreed that if you have no right to reprice within 90 days, I can understand why you would include those in the cash flows. But if the reinsurer has the right to reprice and you have the right to stop selling new contracts, new sessions after 90 days, I believe those cash flows should be outside the boundary of the reinsurance. They should not be included in the measurement of the current reinsurance contract for many of the reasons we discussed last period. So this view, it was unanimous in the Canadian TRG, and it also was strongly expressed by members of the International Actuarial Association. It's an item which is dear to many actuaries' hearts. So that's it.
Not so clear. You said 42 is a problem for you. The rest you agree, but I haven't really understood. You think, okay, if a component can be repriced, even if you can have new contracts, same price, then you is outside. But I understand it is okay. It's the whole contract which is relevant, not only a component.
Yeah, no, I disagree with that when it's an addition.
You disagree with
yes,
that?
Yes, yes.
Do you think the word is clear in the standard? That okay?
I think my reading of the standard and all the other discussions is clear that if you have the right if you have the right to set the terms as a new contract, that would be
only for only for a component, not for the whole contract. Then you think, okay, it's outside.
Yes.
So, Leslie, would you think of that component as meeting the substance over form consideration of actually being a separate contract?
I would from the perspective of the boundary, but often it would not in reality be a separate contract. For example, it happens with riders or voluntary additions of coverage on an insurance product. I mean, if there was more flexibility in terms of separation of components, of insurance components, we might be able to get there, to be able to say that an optional addition at a later point in time is a separate component, which you haven't written yet. But then when it gets added, it becomes a reassessment of the contract boundary at that point in time. In other words, beforehand, it's outside the contract boundary, but then when somebody actually elects it, of course you take it into account because you're reassessing the boundary.
So what words are you reading, Leslie? Assuming that you haven't separated it out at the start, which words are you reading that get you to that conclusion?
Paragraph 34, B24, and then what I saw the staff discussion on the boundary as. Before. Plus, our understanding from our discussion last time, which turned out to be different than I thought, on the reinsurance contract. It's necessary to reflect the substantive rights and obligations. But just because I've granted an option to a contract holder to add coverage if that option is at terms and conditions that I'm going to set at future that are equivalent to a new contract, I think that's not a substantive right and obligation from the perspective of the cash flows that you should include in the boundary of the contract.
I guess my question is to you, is guaranteed insurability has no substance in those contracts?
I would not say that.
Because I understand that if you determine all the terms in the future, you consider this a future contract. But you did guarantee something. You guaranteed insurability, I assume, because if this person comes, and I don't know if it's health coverage, and he's in a very poor health condition, you cannot send them back home and say, I'm
not agree that that
so
is...
There is some obligation there?
I agree that that is a consideration in deciding whether you have made a substantive whether you have a substantive right and obligation now. I do have to assess whether I have given any substantive right and obligation. And in that case, I would turn to paper A as well, and I would look to whether the competitive constraints or commercial considerations are similar to those that would apply if I wrote a new contract. And if they're similar, I would similarly ignore it. So I agree, though, there will be circumstances where I have made a commitment of some kind where I do have a substantive obligation, and then I would include it, and we do.
So, Leslie, can I just clarify? What you're saying, I think, is that if you have a rider that can be added at market value on the same terms, which includes the underwriting ability, as a new entrant, then you would see that as being outside a contract boundary?
Yes.
Sergio?
Thank you. I share the problems raised by Leslie on including those future cash flow for options for which the insurer has the practical ability to set the premiums for the additional cover based on the assessed risk at the time when the option is exercised. But having said that, you know, I look at the fact pattern presented here, and in the paper, it describes a scenario in which the insurer is obligated to provide coverage when the policyholder exercises the option. That already exists and defined in the contract. This is in paragraph 34, you know, particularly the word obligated. So on that basis, I would agree with the analysis in the paper from a technical accounting perspective, given the presence of substantive obligation. However, in cases where the added coverage will be re-underwritten, and especially when the insurer can reject those applications for the additional coverage, I would conclude, you know, in that situation, the insurer does not have a substantive obligation to provide that coverage. And in such cases, I believe the related cash flow should not be included within the contract boundary.
I share a similar view as Leslie and Central. I think, first I read that, I think is that the ability to reprise only the option or the rider makes sense, but I don't know if it's practically possible that you reprise the whole contract. I don't think it will happen. And also, I think in practice, if there's only such things, and you quite difficult to estimate everything. And I think it's also necessary to emphasize that the right should be substantial, right, for the paragraph 43, because in paragraph 72 in IFRS 17, it's not that clear to say that. I'll give an example. If I know it might not be reality, but if you sell an insurance contract and you say that you have option to buy any insurance policies we sold in the future, that's always right? But in that case, you cannot reprise the whole contract, and you should. How do you do? You should project everything into your contract. It's not make any real sense, and I don't know if it's possible to do so. So I think whether I read the standard, I don't think I have the understanding that you need to reprise the whole contract.
I'll just reflect on one thing that was mentioned here about the view that in some cases that additional voluntary premium has no substance. So paragraph 2 of the standard says that contractual terms include all terms in a contract, explicit or implied, but an entity should disregard terms that have no commercial substance. I'm not quite sure or convinced that if you include some this kind of optionality in a contract, it has no commercial substance, but just to reflect upon that, the thought that the standard is equipped to deal with conditions that have no commercial substance. It's not, I guess, for our discussion to judge if it's engaged in different fact patterns, but
there's quite
maybe
a
something to think about.
And I agree with Hagip. I think this submission is not about is that kind of option has this commercial substance, yes or no. The question is if it has commercial substance, because it is then okay, the conclusion is okay, is it in the contract boundary? Mm-hmm. And maybe we should concentrate on that because we don't have specific pack patterns, okay, when maybe it is not commercial substance. Massimo.
I guess that this area is one of the most difficult also in the implementation in the potential project because, let's say, contract boundaries is linked to a lot of other things, acquisition cost, CSM release. We have the topic of the reinsurance separation. So it's a ground that it's quite complex also because the kind of the contract that we have in the different jurisdiction are different and can have also different pricing rationales. But having said that, I agree with the observation of Leslie in the sense that usually we think that if there is an option that to increase insurance coverage, add insurance coverage that is totally out of the control at the moment of issuing the contract, I would find very difficult to consider these cash flows within the contract boundaries. And this would create a lot of volatility in the valuation and also some operational constraints. So if this kind of option are in substance, like a new contract, I would prefer, let's say, to read the contract boundaries in the sense that this is a new contract rather than add something more in the contract boundaries.
But again, you're talking about where there's a substantive obligation. Yes?
Yes.
Because my understanding was, okay, we have said, okay, we should look at this together because we were told, okay, to split this, that is complex. To split the cash flows, if you have different elements, options, and other coverage, that is difficult. But you are saying now it is difficult to combine it, so I'm confused.
It's difficult to, there are cases, for example, my view is that if I have a different components and one of the components is, can be repriced annually, but let's say the base contract is long-term in nature, I would like to avoid that let's say, the fact that I'm able to reprice a single coverage may interfere with the main principle of one contract, one boundary. But there are other kind of options, and let's say, for example, to add in a certain point in time, new riders that are completely out of, let's say, the set of rights and obligations set out at inception, that would be very difficult to measure at the time in which I'm selling the contract. And let's say saying that the only trigger is that the overall bundle contract should be renewed, would imply a lot of operational and measurement troubles in the valuation.
And I agree it is maybe difficult to judge that. But do you agree with the conclusion that if the option has economic or commercial substance and you maybe can reprice then the new option, but you cannot the rest of the contract, then that is in the contract boundary? Because that is the question.
Given the words in the standard.
Given the words in the standard. Do you have the same conclusion or do you think the standard is not clear? Or do you say, okay, I don't like it, but it's a different thing?
I don't think that is so explicit in the standard that this is...
Even though it says fully reflects.
Yeah.
And it is a contract boundary, a contract boundary.
Joe?
Well, I was just going to... Because you can have options. Options can exist, but... people may not take them. And so I think in terms of defining that it's a substantive option, I think you've got to have a reasonable expectation that that people will actually take up that option. Well, sometimes people will take that option at inception and then you know where you are. And sometimes they won't take it at inception and they could later
but they don't. You've got no evidence of anybody doing that. So I think there is just because the option exists doesn't necessarily mean that it would create it in the contract boundary if you haven't got a reasonable expectation.
But I think that is a different topic, because that is not the topic of this paper. Maybe there is difficulty to judge that. I agree to that, but it's a different topic. But would you agree, if there is a kind of substance has some obligation for the entity, that, you should judge the whole contract if it can change, or do you think, standard is clear or not in this?
I think the principle is, to me, the principle that can you reprice as for a new customer? And I think that we ultimately need to come back to that test, because there's a lot of complexity in practice and terms and options and so on. But if we can say, can I do for that what I would do for a new customer, then I think it's outside the boundary.
Even though it's only a piece of the contract.
I think Leslie was next.
I think there's a difference between no commercial substance and having substantive rights and obligations. Just to answer your issue, I think one is a higher bar than the other. I think we could have an option that has commercial substance but has no substantive rights and obligations that exist before the person has elected the option. And to your terms of separating cash flows, that's not an issue here, because we're talking about future additions. It's not in your current cash flows. When they add the coverage or elect the option, then you include it in the cash flows that you're measuring. You don't have the issue. Not that I have a problem with separation of cash flows. I don't. But but if you, I think that's irrelevant to this particular question.
Kevin first.
I was just struggling to understand, I guess, in the paper, when would you be able to reprice the option, but say actually there is kind of some substantive obligation. So, I think we're saying if there isn't a substantive obligation, then it's not in here. But we're talking about the guaranteed versus the you can reprice. And we're saying you treat them the same. But I don't really understand how the you can reprice is giving you any substantive obligation, right? I mean, you talked about guaranteed insurability. If you can reprice, you can charge the highest premium imaginable and the person won't renew, right? So if you've got the right to reprice, it doesn't feel like there is any substantive obligation or any commercial substance. So what are we thinking about here?
I think it touches a bit our previous or the other part of the paper. I'm not sure if you can, but you can tell me if you can actually charge a price that is unimaginable just to deal with the risk in terms of practical terms. But you might.
I think you're using the words that you can fully reprice to reflect the risk.
The risk.
So that's the same thing, right?
But I think there is a kind of obligation, man. I have car insurance, which some insurance are not giving me car insurance because I don't like the car which I have. If I would have an option, maybe, there is an obligation for this company to insure this car, even if they usually don't do it. In health, they have also, to refuse a kind because they think Martin Edelman is so bad condition, I don't want to cover them. But it is a debate for a different scenario. When is it kind of this obligation, yes or no? But I think we can have different views. I don't think it's the conclusion of today. When is there substantive and when is rights obligation? JP.
This second issue is again about determining the contract boundary in case of the insurance contract having an option to add an option. Right? And as you know, speaking from the accountant perspective, I think this kind of option, if it has something substantive obligation or rights at the inception, those kind of options need to be considered as kind of one of the polishing of this behavior at inception. Those cash flows, if it has something valuable at inception, need to be included in estimating cash flow. That's what I know. And speaking of the standard, I think it is clear, straightforward, and it's easier to understand, because I kept saying that the country boundary assessment that should be performed at the whole country level, including options, if those options have substantive rights and obligations. So I have no doubt about that.
So we need some further. Gail, Mary, Jens, what do you think?
I fully agree with the conclusion. So I'm fine with what is written in the paper. I only have just one recommendation. It's about the flowchart in A1. And as we have already touched base and discussed separation and combining components of a contract, I would recommend in the first box that you phrase or rephrase the question not to be stated as, does the entity consider that the option is a separate contract? I would suggest to say, is the option a separate contract? So that the question is shortened, because when you start with a question with, does the entity consider, for me always this sounds like there is a policy choice that depends on who is the entity. So I always like short questions. So for me, the short question would be, is the option a separate contract? Sounds much more reasonable for me. So this is my only recommendation to the flowchart. It's for me easier to start into the flowchart when I know there is no entity assessment. So that's my only recommendation. Otherwise, I'm absolutely fine with the paper as it is drafted.
Gail?
I think I'm fine with the paper. The bit, having heard this discussion, which I thought we were going to have, the difficulty I think a number of people have, and I think it's where Leslie's coming from, is, and I think I had thought the same before, if you have an option that has an unlimited price, it feels like it's not worth a lot to me because it can be priced out. They really don't want to give me health insurance. They can charge me $1 million and I'm not going to take it. So I think... So I had sort of thought those were outside of the boundary, but I do think the words get you to where the paper is. But I'm not sure it changes it, because if I have that ability, I almost don't think there is a substantive right or obligation or commercial substance. So it might not change what I do with it in any case. So I think the analysis is right, but it might not change what you do in your numbers. And I think that's why I managed to get myself that I was okay with it, even though it wasn't where I started in the first place. If that helps.
Daryl and then Leslie?
I was just going to say, if we're talking, after Jens's comment, if we're talking about the flowchart, I think that question about is it substantive is a question that needs to come in as part of that process too, because I think that may eliminate some of the things that we're thinking about that have been thrown around on the table.
I would agree. To me, it focuses on whether there's a substantive right or obligation. I have no problem with that. The problem I do have in the paper is that it equates no substantive right or obligation with the right to reprice the entire contract, and it's that I disagree with. You will almost never have the right, or there are many cases where you will not have the right to reprice the entire contract. I agree that the ability to reprice the entire contract does mean there's no substantive right and obligation. It's not that. It's that I think the bar for no substantive right and obligation with these additions is lower than that. I agree, though, and I also agree with Jen's point about the option being a separate contract. There may even be some flexibility in there in thinking of it as a separate contract, in the same way that we think of cash flows beyond the contract boundary as being associated with a new contract. I mean, it's not really going to be a new contract when it renews, is it? It's you reassess the boundary when these additions are made or when these things happen. But conceptually, is it? Essentially, though, I think the focus should be on whether there are substantive rights and obligations associated with that. That's not exactly the same as commercial substance, and it's not exactly the same as being able to reprice the whole contract.
And I tend to agree, man, if you don't have an obligation, man, even if you wouldn't include what kind of cash flow you would include, man, that is what's the problem.
But I think your motor car insurance is a good example of where you may have a hidden obligation that you hadn't thought about.
One other thing that comes up sometimes in Canada, at least, is people think it should hinge on whether the entity intends to reprice. Like, there are some people who think, if the entity has the right to reprice, but you're pretty sure they won't, that you should take that obligation into account. And I think it's clear that that is not the case, right? We are talking about the entity's rights.
Right. Thank you. Hello.
Yeah, I'd just like to agree with the point about whether it is to do with substantive obligation or whether it's to do with commercial substance. I do agree that the flowchart in A1 does need to incorporate that kind of idea, just to avoid the confusion that that you could go off in one direction or the other, because I think the results could be quite different as a result.
Thank you, Francesco.
I just want to understand what is the thinking of the staff at this point regarding the fact that the discussion appears to be that the option to reprice just the one particular risk in that option is not sufficient to take it out of the boundary, but effectively, given that that repricing mechanism makes it such that the policyholder will be potentially walked out, it does effectively create a present value which is after probability weighting very immaterial, so it doesn't matter, but it is still within the boundary. So that would be the first check I would like to make, to ask the staff to help me understand. And the second one is, when I look at the part one and the part two of the same paper, the commercial constraints in the first part would be the kind of things that Leslie was talking about now, and I wasn't entirely sure, given the speed that we went through the first part, whether we actually recorded an outcome. It was view A or view B on that, so because I got that doubt, I was waiting for the outcome, but now it becomes a bit more pressing, given the comments that Leslie has made in terms of expressing what is my view. And if I can be helped by the staff perspective, that would be great. Thanks.
For the first part of the discussion, we did not discuss view A or B. These are the views that the submitter included in their submissions. We have gone through, I guess, there was an agreement with the staff analysis, and this is how we moved to the next step. So we didn't discuss certain views, and we tried to be careful with just picking the views from the submission, and we tried to focus on the analysis of the words in the standard. For the second discussion that we have now, I guess that the place that we are at is that we are looking at contract boundary as analysis that you need to do for a contract. It's in its entirety, because this is how we read the words. It says contract boundary. I think that the other things that we pick up from this discussion as well is that a very important consideration before you even get to contract boundary is you consider whether you have substantive right, obligation with respect to the additional premium. So this is something that you would probably start with. And I think even more importantly was mentioned here, another starting point before you even get to contract boundary is the assessment about separation as well. Because I think that only once, I think that where you start is, first of all, you need to identify what is the contract, you need to assess separation of different components, and it might be the different cases would lead to different outcomes. And then, of course, in that assessment, you need to consider the substantive obligations, and that there is a judgment involved, I guess. In no way this means policy choice. And once we identify the contract with all its substantive right and obligation, I think it's quite clear from the standard that you need to assess the contract boundary for the contract in its entirety. But there is steps in the way, and I think we picked up from the comments here, so I hope it reflects where
that's
we are.
That's very helpful. So in that instance, then I would like to say that my reading of the standard, helped by the analysis of the staff on this paper, is that I can see the view B in the second part to be the one that is more faithfully reflecting what the standard said about the contract boundary, and that option is there, even if you have this great power to reprice everything. But then my view is the standard doesn't actually introduce that commercial constraint, and so whether the insurer may or may not price because of commercial considerations should be irrelevant, based on what the standard wording is. And so view A would be linked to view B in the second part, giving me effectively an immaterial accounting impact when I actually calculate the contract carrying amount for financial reporting purposes. That would be the way I read the standard, read the paper together, and start thinking about how to implement it in practice. I don't know whether that resonates with other members of the TRG, but that's, having listened to this discussion, that's where I probably would land.
which I understand is consistent with what we just said. I'm just saying this because referring to different views, again, is a bit confusing. We really need to focus on what we have in the paper. So, yeah. But I got that it's quite consistent with where we got to so far.
Leslie?
Again, I agree that we're coming around to agreement, which I'm happy about, that it does reflect that we should be reflecting the substantive rights and obligations and how we look at that. Just the one thing, I don't want that to be equated with being able to reprice the whole contract. What was your... I'm not sure I understood what you said.
Effectively, the staff is indicating that this analysis of paragraph 34 says the option is there. We cannot treat it as something which is outside of the boundary. But if you take from the first part the view that commercial considerations don't affect the contract boundary...
I wouldn't say it's in the boundary. It's only in the boundary if it has this... Oh, okay.
I know you said what you said. That's why I want to say why you said...
No, but I thought this... I was hearing the staff agree that if that option doesn't attach substantive rights and obligations to, or substantive obligation to the entity, it's appropriate to not include those cash flows in the contract.
Is that what you said?
That Mark, well, I heard Mark.
It would be an important clarification for me as well, if I can be helped in that regard.
What we said is that, first of all, we need to identify the substantive rights and obligation and then start with it. Right. You'll come with a case, which I cannot judge, and I think none of us should at the moment, that you think that there is an obligation there that does not attach a substantive obligation, obviously it impact your assessment. But I think that it's not responsible to analyze different facts patterns in this instance.
If it is not a substantive right and obligation, we don't have to do that. Because that is in paragraph what you have read just. I think that is... But one, it is not the topic of today. Mm-hmm. That is should be clear. We don't discussing, we have mentioned it, but we don't really should have a kind of discussion about that because we don't have fact patterns. And on the fly, we don't want to discuss. But if it is substantive right and obligation, then it should be included because the whole contract should be even sensory priced, then okay, it is. I think we have agreement. That's what I have heard.
I agree.
And we don't have, I have not heard disagreement about that. Sue maybe has.
I agree with that, but I just feel like a lot of weight's going to be put on how people are thinking about what substantive rights and obligations mean. So I think if people have questions they can think of, reflecting on the discussion later on, it might be a good thing to send something in just to make sure we actually all mean the same thing.
Francesco?
Mm-hmm. That's why the first part is actually quite important, because if a substantive obligation arises as a result of commercial considerations, and I wouldn't read the standard to actually telling me that this is what I need to do, then this could be a problem, even if I've got theoretically the practical ability to reprice fully. If I've got commercial constraints, then suddenly this becomes far more important than it would be if you don't allow commercial constraints. And my personal view by reading the standard in terms of the interaction between part one and two of the paper is that I would actually see what is view A in part one to be the one that I would say that's what the standard says, not view B. And so I would exclude commercial considerations from the assessment of whether or not there is a substantive obligation. In that case, then, I agree with Leslie, then because there is no substantive obligation as a result of the full repricing of the option, then it's not in the boundary.
Again, I don't want the impression to go out that if you have full flexibility in terms of pricing the additional coverage, it means that you don't have a substantive obligation. That's very important.
Right. Yeah.
This is an assessment that needs to be made. But the fact that you can reprice the additional coverage does not mean directly that you don't have a substantive obligation. You need to consider what you have provided to the policyholder, like Martin in his example.
So
it is an assessment. So we need to be very careful not to create that impression outside.
My question is, if I can do an analysis, and this is also the point that JP made at the beginning, you can audit whether these come from laws, contracts, and regulations. That's something that is doable.
So you're going back to the first discussion?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's how, because at the end, the second part is entirely dependent on what is a substantive obligation. And Leslie put it very clearly, saying whether this actually happens or not is another question altogether, which is true. That's why part one is important.
Both parts are very important in the entire analysis.
Indeed.
Both relate to contract boundary.
Paper, yeah.
But we thought it's good for the discussion to try to separate them, because otherwise you'll get specific fact patterns, and yeah, it's hard to manage. But that's okay.
I don't want to put any fact pattern particularly here. I just want to connect the two parts of the same paper together and say when
could have an implication, but not in all cases.
No, absolutely.
Any reason.
But,
can I just clarify, because I'm very confused now, because I had thought in part A we had concluded that we agreed with the staff view, and in paragraph 32 I think it is clear in the paper, of 32 of the paper, that the constraints are not restricted to what's in paragraph 2 of the standard legal regulatory. I didn't think that, but when you read the words in the standard of paragraph 34 of the standard, I think it doesn't talk just about those restricted constraints, which is why I agreed with the staff analysis. I might not like it, but I think that's what the words is. But Francesco, I'm concerned that you're disagreeing with that.
Well, because
am I misunderstanding something?
This is why I wanted to go back to the part one, because the first part, because I wasn't sure whether there was a view expressed one way or another, and then...
Part one, I thought, okay, we had agreement with the staff analysis based on that paper. I'm saying, okay, it could have commercial impact, could have these constraints, but don't have to. I think that was my conclusion on that, and
that's
my silence, I observed silence, I interpreted that as agreement.
Okay.
If that is not true, maybe we should go back to the first issue, and I'm hearing that you agree.
I'm very uncomfortable by making commercial considerations to be a factor that would affect the contract boundary. I don't see the standard words to actually put such a burden on preparers and auditors.
Do you see the standard words limiting the considerations to law, contractual or regulatory? Do you see that limitation? Because we approached this question, you know, we opened the standard,
yes,
and we didn't see this limitation. However, we wanted to see different things. This is what it is, but we draw some kind of distinction in the words. We're saying this is not just any pricing decision.
My reading of the standard and also the analysis that you made, but again, I hear the others that concluded differently, is that it would have supported UA.
Again, I'm sorry very much, Francesco. I'm getting confused. View A is we need to be consistent with what we have in the paper. The paper concludes, or this is where how we read the words, we are saying that the standard does not limit the consideration only to contractual regulatory law, so possibly market a constraint could be relevant. The other thing that we also say, it's not just a pricing, it needs to be a constraint. This was the conclusion of the paper by reading the words, and your silent agreement meant that you feel the same way.
Well, that's why I'm speaking, because I didn't want to join the side.
He disagrees because he thinks view A and view A says, okay, it should not be.
So you don't agree with the third one?
Yeah. My view of the standard words is that I should look at laws, contracts, and regulations.
And Francesco, how do you get there? Is it because of the sort of opening of IFRS 17 that talks about contracts, etc.?
Paragraph 2 is the prominent basis for interpreting the standard. That's why it's been put there for very specific reasons.
But Francesco, paragraph 2 is about what's the contractual terms. We're talking here about practical ability. Do you see those as the same?
I see that the practical ability derived from the insurance contract. That's what we are accounting for.
So you see it as a strict ability rather than just a practical ability?
Yes.
Then.
Because then I can absolutely go on the same page as Leslie on the second part, where we can say that because the practical ability from laws, contracts, and regulations is the way it is, then I've got... I don't need to think about whether I'm going to be constrained by freedom of repricing in 20 years' time, whenever this option is going to be reflected. It's still going to produce the same accounting result.
Yep.
Whilst if I do anticipate some commercial constraints in 20 years' time, then that becomes a substantive obligation, then is in the boundary, then I've got a very demanding implementation to do.
Yeah, so what we're seeing, I guess... So I think whether I agree that how you interpret what is a constraint has an impact on what you think of in the paper. I hear that we misinterpreted the your understanding of the first part of the question. I want first to clarify whether everyone else is comfortable with the way we had characterised that conclusion for themselves, or if everyone, anyone else also agrees with you.
So, Leslie,
say why? I thought practical ability did require us to think about whether we need to go further. And the reason I was okay with this is because it says constraints are irrelevant to the contract boundary assessment if they apply equally to new and existing policyholders in the same market. So that lets me be comfortable with it and also apply it to my position in view B. In other words, my the understanding of whether I can price these other additions the same as I would a new contract, to me, means I can consider them outside the boundary.
They should be also audible from my perspective.
Well, everything has to be auditable.
Exactly. Massimo, you?
I struggle in understanding how the point of commercial constraints may be linked to this option, because if the point is commercial constraint in terms of having the same price of existing contract and new contracts, that is in part one. Here we are talking about option that can come in 20 years. So how you can assess if there is a commercial constraint in setting the price, it's impossible for an option that is available in the future.
But I don't know, why do you give an option to somebody? You must have some in mind, because...
But if you don't have a clue
what this option does mean.
But since the terms and condition will be set at prevailing rate at that time, how I can justify at the moment of the issue of the country if I have a practicability? It's something that is...
Martin, the practicality is convenience for the customer. So if the customer wants to have a critical illness cover and is prepared to go through a medical test to establish a price, it's convenient to do it from an existing contract rather than go and shop around. That's what the insurer would do.
Yeah, but that is our earlier discussion. Man, has it really kind of obligation for the entity, yes or no? And maybe in this you conclude, no, it has not. Because if you're doing it only for nothing, but that is not the topic of today, as I discussed already. There's a different issue.
If the practical ability takes into account commercial considerations, then...
I mean, you cannot judge if you're in 20 years, you can reprice it, and I'm totally with you. That is difficult, right?
Yeah.
So, but we don't have to. So it is also what we say on A, it could have an impact, but it could also don't have an impact.
Yes.
That is what we discussed, I think, on part one of this paper.
Prepared today, and they have to audit today. Yeah. So that's
life is not easy to judge.
I know, it's not.
So if I could sort of try and sum up where I think you're trying to draw the connection. So what we're talking about here is when there's a substantive obligation to provide additional coverage, then you've got to look at what the rights are. What you're talking about is the role of commercial considerations in determining when there is substantive obligation.
Yes.
In part A, we said that commercial considerations might or might not, depending on the situation, have an impact on that substantive obligation, and therefore that has a link into it. But I don't think that means that the discussion we were having in part B is contradictory to the discussion we had in part A.
Not at all. Okay. I agree. I'm not saying that it is contradiction. I just want to link the logic, because then if you have commercial considerations as effectively the way to read the standard, then establishing that this option that can be fully priced in its own right but not the rest of the contract, the boundary or outside the boundary, is very important.
But it's not just all commercial considerations. It needs to be a constraint. So there could be a commercial constraint, but then you've still got the question, which we're not discussing today, is when that is a constraint.
Yeah.
We had a discussion at the Hong Kong TLG, and people were extremely concerned about this. They felt that if that is the way the standard should be read, there is hardly to be a sure boundary at all, because commercial considerations could be argued would be there all the time. And they said, can you put that on the table in London and see whether...
But there will be commercial considerations, but not necessarily a constraint due to commercial considerations. So there will always be a commercial consideration. I agree with that, but they may not be a constraint as a result.
Yeah. And it would have to be a constraint.
Would it prevent you fully pricing?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. And it would have to be a constraint that didn't apply to new customers as well. Yes. Because
And I think that's the difference.
You know, that seems quite
and
a big...
The other example of constraints that we have in the standard are regulatory ones. So you kind of are familiar with the hurdle. It's not just a day-to-day pricing decision. So I guess this is where we are.
Okay.
Sometimes the boundary between commercial strategy and commercial constraint
it's
a question for a different day.
So open up to a lot of judgment.
But I think that was the distinction we were trying to draw between those two paragraphs, whatever they were, 32 and whatever.
Yep.
That it's not just the fact that you think about it, it actually has to be such that it's a constraint.
It's
quite a big deal.
Otherwise,
it's
open up.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Do we need a summary?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Who will? Better, will you try?
I try. Okay. So, shall I maybe just recap also the conclusion for the topic A?
Yes. Don't mix them up.
Okay. So, I think that we agree on the principle that it's clear that limitations are relevant only if you apply to existing customers and not to new customers. So, if they equally apply, they're not relevant. Judgment is required to understand which commercial consideration might be constrained. So those commercial considerations in some cases might be relevant, in other not. Mm-hmm. On the second topic about options to add coverage, I think that we said that one thing to consider is if the option might be a separate contract. So for that option treated as a separate contract, the contract boundary should be performed separately from the remainder of the contract. Then the focus should be on the substantive rights and obligations arising from this option. In the paper, we mentioned that for option with that are not guaranteed, so when there is this possibility to reprice at the option exercise date, we need to consider the contract in its entirety. So for the option to be excluded from the contract boundary, it should be possible to reprice the full contract, not just the additional piece represented by the option. But I also remember that some of the TRG members have a different view, and they consider that the pricing should apply to the option in isolation. And finally, if the option is part of the contract boundary, this fact should be reflected in measurement, and there might be situations where the measurement of the option, because of the probability of exercising the option, the pricing in the future, might have an immaterial impact on the measurement. But this does not mean that the option is outside the contract boundary.
And I think the other point that we also mentioned is that the mere fact that you can reprice the additional cash flows coming out of the option does not mean that there is no substantive obligation, which is very important.
I would also want to add, though, that the ability to reprice the whole contract is not a necessary condition for there being no substantive rights and obligations associated with the optional addition.
But it's a strong indication.
So.
No, not even. I want the assessment of whether the optional addition has created, at the reporting date, substantive rights and obligation.
That seems like it gets into the second issue, which I think Sue raised, which is that might be this whole concept of discussion about substantive rights and obligation may be something that needs to come back.
Yeah.
I think that's straying into what is a substantive right and obligation.
I thought we were pretty much in agreement of that piece. Martin said he's with us over and over again. I don't really want to get back into picking and choosing when it's there's all sorts of things that will go in. It's a matter of judgment to some extent. And whether you can reprice the same as a new contract is an important consideration in assessing whether there's a substantive right and obligation, whether you can reprice the
whole
contract.
We have not discussed that today. I agree to that, but if that is an issue, I think we should
discuss it next time.
That
and not
is
this, because
this issue.
But we have not a paper discussing that
when
issue. And people are not prepared. People are not prepared for this thing.
This paper,
I mean, I think the problem here is that this paper works through an analysis with this being a substantive
Exactly. That is an assumption in this
paper. I agree with you that there are circumstances in which this may not be a substantive obligation, but I think my concern here would be that we are making a judgment on a piece of what a substantive obligation is without thinking about what the effect is around the edges of that. So I think that's the context of this paper is that we've reached, we've worked on the assumption that it is already a substantive right and obligation. We're just deciding how to treat that.
If that's added, I can live with it.
Okay. Thanks, Leslie. Thanks, Roberta. Thank you. Anne-Marie.